If you're looking for a way to help birds or take your support to the next level, this May, I would love for you to join the Birds Canada Birdathon. It's easy to participate in and helps raise thousands of dollars for bird conservation. Learn more at birdscanada.org/birdathon. Now let's get to the episode. You're listening to The Warblers, a Birds Canada podcast. I'm Andrea Gress. Join me and others as we travel on common flight paths with our guests, gaining insight and inspiration from the world of birds and bird conservation in Canada. Welcome back to the Battle of the Beaks. Six contenders enter the ring. Only one will survive. Okay, that's a bit dramatic. We love all birds here at Birds Canada. This is the Warblers Podcast. You are listening to the second episode of a two-part series. Be sure to listen to the first episode as well, which was released just last week. So we've got three more contenders joining us today to tell us about their favorite bird beaks. You will soon be able to vote on the very best one, and the competition is fierce, let me tell ya. Let's dive on in.
Hi, everybody. My name is John Kinghorn, and I am talking to you all from Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm going to be chatting to you guys today about the amazing beak bill of the African open bill. Now, when I was asked to find a bill of a bird species that really, really stood out for me from the African continent, a lot of our birds, I must be quite honest, have very dull bills, although they have special functions. I needed to try and find something which was going to grasp everybody and which I could throw into the hat as contender for one of the world's most incredible bills. An African open bill is one of two species in the world. You also get the Asian open bill, but its bill is remarkable, and it's obviously its namesake as well. It has an incredible function, and I'm going to dive into that a little bit later. You know, the open bill itself is fairly widespread. It occurs across most of sub-Saharan Africa, even in Madagascar. Obviously, the Asian open bill is limited specifically to Asia itself. Obviously, we're here to talk about the African open bill, and its coloration is stunning. It's a fairly large stork-like bird. It has these gorgeous, gorgeous, shiny iridescent feathers on its back. Quite a hefty little thing as well, 79 to 90 centimeters, up to 1.3 kilograms as well. So it's definitely not something that you're going to see running around your lawn. although I think in certain places in Africa, you do see them a lot more frequently in suburbia than other places. The open bill itself gets its name, like I said earlier, from its bill. It's got a gap of roughly 6 millimeters, smack bang, in the middle of the bill itself. It really is quite obscure.
Oh, you've just got to pull up a photo of the African open bill. Imagine a stork that came straight from a Jurassic Park movie. Like, these are big birds, bigger than a toddler. They'd probably come up to my waist. I'm pretty tall. But their bill is like, it's very dinosaur-like. They're really cool. I really like them.
Juveniles don't have the roughly 6 millimeter gap in their bill, but the adult birds are very, very characteristic. The bill itself, a lot of people will refer to it, especially if you come down here to Africa and you head out onto a game drive with some bird guides or even just normal nature guides. They'll often say to you when they find an open bill, oh, well, this uses it as a nutcracker. It's basically a glorified nutcracker. And that's not necessarily the case with these birds. They can use it as a nutcracking type mechanism, but at the end of the day, the real purpose for it is for purposes of grappling the food sources that they're after. Now, these birds feed specifically on snails and mussels, freshwater snails and mussels, that is. And the shape of the bill is incredible, is that it allows it to grab onto the hardy yet slimy shells of both the snails and the mussels. And the way that it's designed prevents those snails or mussels from sliding out of the grasp of the bill. However, in situations where it is required, these guys can obviously use it as a multifunctional tool and obviously crack open any shell or attempt to crack open any shell as best they can of any stubborn snail or mussel. The way they open or utilize this incredible bill is quite simple in that the lower part of the mandible is quite sharp. And what they do is they position the muscle or snail in such a way that they're able to maneuver the sharp-edged lower part of that mandible into the open parts of, be it the snail or the muscle, and obviously wedge open whatever hard exterior that might be keeping the soft innards of that mollusk intact. And obviously once they pry that open, they're able to get into the good stuff. And that's what they are after, essentially. It can take 15 seconds in the events of snails. It can take up to 10 minutes, perhaps even longer, for them to now sift through and try and pry open the snail and mussel shell so that they can feed on the innards. So it can be quite a process and quite comic watching them as well. And they also have this incredible habit of collecting as many mussels as they can, taking them to the nearest shore, placing them in the shore in the hot baking sun on the sandbank, and they'll let these mussels lie there for 30 minutes, an hour, perhaps even longer, just to try and get them to warm up, dehydrate, and then obviously open up just marginally enough for them to obviously gain access into them using that incredible bill of theirs. So the bill itself is remarkable, and I personally think, after consideration, I mean, I could have gone for, you know, Cape Sugarbird or any one of our other endemic birds, but at the end of the day, I think the African open bull is a species characteristic and of the continent, that is. And like I said, even though we get them in Asia as well, in the Asian open bull, its bill modification, I think, is one that the world needs to appreciate more.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it sounds like kind of a neat adaptation for dealing with a food source. And it's a big bird and a big bill, and it's tackling kind of a small food source with that big bill. And I find that kind of fascinating in itself. And your point about how it takes the mussels over to the shore to let them warm up is also just a fun intelligence fact. You know, the things that birds figure out and how they go about hunting and dealing with food sources is really fascinating.
No, 100%. And I mean, these guys are super specialists when it comes to their niche prey items. And unfortunately, I mean, it can also be to their downfall as well. I mean, as it stands, and although they're locally quite abundant across obviously the African continent and into Asia as well, their populations are going to start decreasing. And it's numerous things. These birds get, obviously, because they're in and around fishing villages, coastlines, dams, rural areas, where a lot of fishing is taking place. They often get entangled in fishing lines. There's the ever-present habitat destruction, which is a threat for every single bird species out of there. Their association with water, and obviously their specified food source being based in freshwater itself. Pollution of water sources can affect their food supply. And then, unfortunately, as well, in one or two African countries, these birds find themselves getting poisoned and then caught for purposes of consumption in the bushmeat trade. Kenya is, unfortunately, an example where that takes place. And it's not only these guys. I mean, the likes of vultures, likewise, are taking an absolute hammering. And Kenya is, unfortunately, a country where a lot of conservation organizations are doing their best to just try and educate people not to poison animals and not to poison bird populations. A lot of education projects, conservation projects going on in that regard. What they do in Kenya when it comes to the open bulls is that they use a live decoy. They place it in an area nearby one of these stork roosts. Obviously, you know, one of these heronries or stork roosts, you obviously understand that herons and storks roost or culminate together in large numbers, especially in the early mornings and evenings. They might have nests in the shed, nesting location, or they might simply just be roosting there for the morning or for the evening, should I say. And what happens is they essentially get somebody to go and disturb them, and then they inevitably take flight, fly around and locate the live decoy. They land by the live decoy, and then there's a whole bunch of placed around mussels and snails and that have been laced with poison. The open bulls then proceed to consume the mussels and snails and end up passing on, and then obviously they collect the bodies and then they trade them in the bushmeat trade. Unfortunately, that's still very, very rife in parts of Africa, especially East Africa, and it is a major problem. So although they are around in large, large numbers, as with any other animal species or bird species on the world, at the end of the day, if we continue to abuse these animals by means of habitat destruction or simply poaching, at the end of the day, it will only be so much time until it starts to show in their populations. So it is unfortunate, but even more the reason why we need to, you know, carry on preaching the word about even these most common birds. I think there's a favorite saying of a fellow bird guide of mine, who says it's important that we keep the common birds common. And I think that's absolutely imperative, because a common bird is not going to remain common forever if we continue to go down this path that we honor as a race.
Good reason to feature the bird for this episode too, is just continuing to raise awareness and let more people know about these kinds of issues.
Yeah, no, 100%. Absolutely love the birds, and I think it's a very likable species. Listen, it's not, you know, it's not a marvelous spatula tail or a bird of paradise, but at the end of the day, it's a pretty rad bird. It's got an awesome adaptation, and I think it deserves some limelight. I think it stands a good chance at putting its name in the hat for top contender, and I just hope that everybody obviously chooses the African Open Bill.
I've gotten quite familiar with bird conservation issues in Canada and the United States, as I'm sure many of you have. Often it's habitat loss as a result of human activities. You know, we can engage the forestry industry when we find that activities are harmful for bicknose thrush, for example, or we can work with beachgoers to benefit piping plovers and their beach habitats. But poaching for food is a different kind of challenge altogether that the African Open Bills are facing. John let us know that BirdLife International, and more locally BirdLife South Africa, is working on a ton of important projects. He also wanted to mention that Nature Kenya is doing some really solid work. One of his passions is vulture conservation, and that's a really big thing that Nature Kenya is involved in.
Once one vulture, for example, will have a nest in the Kruger National Park in eastern South Africa, and will literally fly and feed in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Botswana, and then come all the way back into South Africa again. And although there's not many issues in South Africa, the minute they cross into Botswana, there is issues. And obviously that's affecting the population, and because they travel such insane distances. So yeah, if you guys do a podcast on vultures, please. there's a lot of things that I would love to chat about.
We might have to have a vulture episode. I'm pretty intrigued. Let us know by writing a review or leaving some comments on our social media if you'd like to hear more about vultures. This episode is sponsored by Birds and Beans. Honestly, this is my go-to coffee every morning. Birds and Beans was founded to help save migratory songbirds by roasting and selling only 100% Smithsonian certified bird-friendly beans. So if you drink coffee and want to help birds, check them out at birdsandbeans.ca. Free shipping in Canada for coffee orders over $45. Birds and Beans will even donate 10% from your coffee purchase if you order from birdsandbeans.ca/warblers. Or use the link in the episode description. Birds and Beans, a richer taste, a richer earth. Okay, so you've just heard from the African Open Bill for Best Beak. Next up, we're leaving the African continent and heading up to the North Pacific Ocean.
I'm Sarah Gutowski, joining from Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I'm here to make a very convincing argument for why Laysan albatross have the most impressive beak of all. So the Laysan albatross, most of them nest in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, but they range across the entire North Pacific Ocean because they are a true seabird. So they can be found off the continental shelf of British Columbia in Canada, but also, you know, south to California and across over to Japan and Kamchatka and all the way around to Alaska and just about everywhere in between. So they are really truly birds of the North Pacific Ocean. They are a huge, elegant seabird with that sort of classic dark upper wing and mostly white otherwise, except for their face, which has this dark patch around the eye with a little bit of like a smoky makeup look going on with a sort of a soft charcoal like smudge on the cheek. I'm biased. I think they're the best, but they are the most beautiful. And the bill is an important piece of that beauty. So they have these long and slender bills with a sort of an elegant curve on the top and a peachy color to the bill with a dusky tip. And they have this unique feature on their bill that they have these two separate small tubes on either side of their bill, and that houses the nostrils. So that's sort of where they live and what they look like. Why is it the coolest bill? Well, because I think it has maybe the craziest diversity and juxtaposition in its function. So the albatross bill is a formidable tool for capturing prey or warding off competitors, but it's also a highly advanced smell detection system for navigating on the open ocean. It's a desalination system for consuming salt water. It's a musical instrument for courtship displays, and it's a delicate sort of appendage for tender interactions with a mate. So when I think of an albatross bill, and the Laysan albatross in particular, it's like a Swiss Army knife. So they have this long bill with this razor sharp edge and a very seriously hooked tip, and they use that for grabbing and tearing prey or fighting off other birds. And they find that prey with their incredible sense of smell, and the bill plays a really big role in that. So those external tubes on the bill that I described, those play a key role in concentrating odors that are then processed by the olfactory bulb or the smell sense organ, which in albatrosses is huge. So for context, the olfactory bulb of albatrosses occupies something like 37% of their brain volume compared to 3% in most other birds. So they use smell and they use that bill and their nose to find food in the open ocean environment. And they also likely use it to navigate more generally, as though the ocean were a smellscape with smelly signposts that say this way toward land and this way to the colony and this way to the grocery store. And those tubes on the bill also likely act kind of like a pitot tube on an airplane, which detects changes in air pressure. And that's really important for albatrosses because they rely so heavily on wind and pressure gradients for flight. So that's another function of their incredible bill. But then back to eating food from the marine environment, their oceanic lifestyle and seafood diet means that they consume a lot of seawater and salt. So one of the ways they deal with that is related to their bill. They have these specialized salt glands that are above the eye that draw sodium out of the bloodstream and produce this highly concentrated salt solution. And then that is sent back out from the nostril tubes on the bill. And then that sort of salty, salty water runs down a groove along the sides of the bill and drips off the hooked tip. And that's why if you look at gulls, often they look like they have a runny nose with these drips at the tip of the bill. That's this hypersaline solution dripping out of the bill from that desalination system that is related to the bill. And then with all of that sort of really, you know, sort of impressive functionality, they also use that dangerous sharp tip for the most delicate acts with their partner. So they use something called allopreening, which is just when birds preen each other, often in places that they can't reach themselves. And they do that partly to build and maintain really strong pair bonds. So in a truly long-term monogamous species like a Laysan albatross, that pair bond is really, really important. And so they use the very tip of their bill like a little pair of tweezers, and they go through the tiny feathers around the eyes and on the face and on the head and help their partner, their mate, to get at all those things that they can't preen away themselves. And when you watch them do it, it looks like the bird being preened is genuinely enjoying it. And then on top of all that, they use their bills in their courtship displays. So when they're looking to attract a mate, they've got lots of dance moves and these dance routines that they do. But one of them involves this machine gun fast clacking of the bill where they sort of snap the top and bottom part of the bill together. And it makes this incredible sound. And at the start of the breeding season on an albatross colony, there's just this cacophony of clacking going on when thousands of birds are courting and sort of setting up those important pair bonds. So again, I just, I think it's pretty easy to make the argument that albatross have the best bills. They're like the Swiss Army knife of beaks, really.
Yeah, bringing in a really compelling argument. I like the Swiss Army knife comparison. So they've got super navigation skills, smell skills, specialized salt filtration, preening for pair bonds, and then the courtship ritual all rolled into one bill. That is a pretty impressive argument.
Yeah, and don't forget it's like a super sharp machete for sort of ripping apart food when they find it.
Absolutely. Of course, you got to eat.
You got to eat.
Is there anything else you want to add to the argument?
Well, I think it's worth, you know, acknowledging that the albatross bill is impressive, but also it's sort of what gets them into a lot of trouble because, you know, seabirds are one of the most endangered groups of birds, and albatrosses in particular are in sort of the worst situation of them all. And they face a lot of threats, and one of them is bycatch in fisheries. And the reason that's such a problem is because they're so good at finding food with their nose and their bill that they can really easily find fishing vessels that are baiting longline hooks. And then they grab that bait on the hook and they unfortunately drown on the hook. And so, I don't know, for me thinking about albatross bills, it does make me think of the unfortunate reality that those bills are getting them into a lot of trouble.
We could go pretty deep into the many other threats that albatrosses face. And in fact, we have. You can listen to a full episode about these wonderful birds. Head over and listen to The Seabirds You Did Not Know You Love, where Sarah joined us to just deep dive into albatrosses. Super interesting. But while we're on the topic of the fishing industry as a threat for albatrosses, Sarah let us know about a pretty neat new innovation that's helping to tackle that threat.
I think some of the most important work being done today is by a company called HookPod, and they've designed this innovative way to keep birds off the hooks, you know, albatrosses and other seabirds. So they've made this hook shielding device that pops open and releases the hook once it reaches depths that are out of the reach of the birds. So it's really easy to use, it's really efficient. And I really commend them for thinking outside the box to find a solution that benefits fishermen and birds and is a great business model too. So I just think it would be great to see more of that kind of innovation in conservation in general.
That was the Laysan albatross coming in as a fierce contender with a Swiss Army knife beak. We have one more beak for you folks from a longtime friend of ours, and then voting will open up. Welcome back, buddy. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I'm so happy to be back in the podcast. I've missed it a lot.
We missed you too. I know we teased for listeners that you'd be back on, and obviously we're going to find an excuse to have you back on the podcast when we can. And what better excuse than nerding out about cool beaks?
You brought me back for the most important episode of all.
This is
it. I need to come here and build the case for my bird. My name is Andres Jimenez, and I am coming to you from Tacoronto, where the trees used to meet the water, part of the Dish with One Spoon territory, home of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and the Mississaugas of the Credit, also known as Toronto, in what is now known as Canada. And I've chosen a beak that is part of the group of birds that takes everything to the extreme. They have the highest metabolic rate of all vertebrates. They have an extreme coevolution with plants. They hover, which is the most metabolically expensive form of movement, and they are bold and brave. As you might notice, I have chosen a hummingbird. I know, this might feel a little cliche, a little bit of a cliche choice. Hummingbird beaks are awesome, hummingbirds are awesome, but I have selected the most awesome bill of all hummingbirds, the white tip sickle bill, Eutoxeres aquila. The bill looks like a sickle. A sickle, yes, I had to Google what a sickle was. I had no idea what it was. It's like a grass hook, a single-handed agricultural blade typically used for harvesting. The scientific name of this animal, Eutoxeres aquila, means two things. Furnished with a bow, meaning a bow attached to the face, or eagle-like bill, because yes, they have the most extremely hooked bill. Why is this beak the coolest one? To understand why the bill of the sicklebill is incredibly amazing, we first need to talk about hummingbirds. For years, we have known that hummingbirds' beak have been shaped by coevolution with flowers. Coevolution means that they have beaks that perfectly match flower corollas in length and shape. Plants have been in charge of shaping this relationship, and hummingbirds have been happy to oblige to get a free quality meal that keeps them hovering. Why does coevolution between hummingbirds and plants happen? Well, by adapting the beak to one species of flower, hummingbirds would be more efficient at extracting nectar and would optimize their foraging to a certain species, meaning that they get more food and reduce the competition with other hummingbirds. They get access to a restaurant that only caters to them. Plants, on the other hand, increase their chance of pollination by moving from an Uber for their pollen to a private driver that would mostly or only visit flowers from the same species, hence securing pollinator services. This is enough to select hummingbirds as the winners of the Beak World Cup, but there is more. In recent years, we have discovered that feeding and flower shape were not the only evolutionary forces sculpting hummingbird beaks. It turns out that hummingbirds are also vicious fighters, carrying sharp weapons attached to their faces. This might be new information to you, but it was not for the Aztecs, whose god of war and the sun was called Huitzilopochtli, represented as a hummingbird or an eagle. The Aztecs were well aware that hummingbirds are vicious warriors that protect flower patches from their rivals. The research from Alejandro Rico Guevara used high-speed cameras to determine that fighting is as much as a force than feeding ecology. Competing with other hummingbirds for food has transformed those beaks into shorter, stronger, sharp, dangerous weapons. Some hummingbirds even have hooked, serrated bills like a saw. I didn't know this until this episode. They use them to tear out other bird feathers. This means that hummingbirds can be crappy at efficiently drinking nectar as long as they are the only ones accessing the flowers. And there is more! Yes, there is more! Hummingbirds have also different shaped bills between male and females from the same species. This can be seen in some species of hermits, where females have a bill that is 40% longer than males and more curved. Why? The theory is that male competition has taken males to have shorter, straight bills, and nest building has favored curved bills on females. Furthermore, having bills shaped differently can reduce competition for flowers between males and females of the same species, taking them to access slightly different flowers. All of this to say that hummingbirds carry a multi-tool attached to their faces, used as a straw, a sword, and a weaving tool. That, for me, makes them winners. Yet, I have selected the sicklebill, remember? The sicklebill has an impossible, unrealistic bill. It is so curved that it allows the hummingbird to access flower tubes that curve at 90% angle from the horizontal. 90%! It is so adapted to these flowers that this hummingbird has given up one of its most important evolutionary adaptations for feeding nectar: hovering. Its bill is so unrealistically curved that it must stop to eat, it must perch to eat, making it vulnerable to predators. Can you believe it? It gave up on hovering to secure more feeding efficiency and to develop a deep relationship with their favorite flower. In fact, sicklebills are a type of hermit, and molecular data suggests that evolutionary hermit hummingbirds appear roughly at the same time as heliconias, their favorite long and curved flower.
I like that little point about the Aztecs seeing hummingbirds for the true badasses that they are. Very, very cool. And where can we find this bird?
Of course, I was going to choose a Costa Rican species. So if you go to Costa Rica, you can see it. But you can find the white-tipped sicklebill in middle elevations, 700 to 2,000 meters above sea level, of Central America and South America. Not all across South America. I would say countries in the Andes, Colombia, Peru, Ecuador. And look for the flowers Centropogon and heliconias. Heliconias we've all seen on the movies, so look for heliconias. And if you see them once, stay near that flower, as the sicklebill eats by trap lining, which means they have a set route of plants that they constantly check during the day, so it will come back.
Do you know if there are conservation concerns for this species?
I know that the IUCN has assessed the white-tipped sicklebill as being of least concern, though its population has not been quantified and its trend is not known. It is a forest-dwelling species that depends on flowers for nectar and so could be threatened by forest fragmentation. So far, it seems that they're doing okay.
Okay, that's actually really lovely to hear.
With that said, I've only seen once in my life in Costa Rica and I birded a lot, so they are not that common.
Any way folks could help this bird if they wanted to?
Buy bird-friendly coffee that supports forests in Central and South America. And that will be a great way of supporting white-tipped sicklebills.
Really good way to just support that habitat, make sure that remains there for those species, and also for an abundance of Canadian birds that winter down in those regions.
Absolutely. Yep, I had a lot of fun.
Cool.
I hope I win. I don't know if there's going to be a winner, but I really hope I win.
There's going to be some fierce competition. Everyone's bringing A game to these. And that brings us to the end. Over the last two episodes, you've heard from six fantastic folks about some of the world's best beaks. We'll tell you how to vote on your favorite in just a moment, but once again, we've heard from Hazel Wheeler with the loggerhead shrike, a small songbird who can take down prey 1.3 times their size. Russell Cannings with the New Zealand ryebill, a bizarre quirk of nature with an asymmetrical bill that seems perfectly suited to foraging along riverbeds. Katja Kochvar coming in strong with the Atlantic puffin, a beak that becomes more vibrant and complex during the breeding season. And of course, today we've heard from John Kinghorn with the African openbill, a prehistoric-looking stork who uses a large adapted bill for very small prey. Sarah Gutowski, a returning guest with a compelling argument for the Swiss Army knife of bills on the Laysan albatross. And finally, Andres Jimenez, our dear friend, arguing for the white-tipped sicklebill, a bill with such an extreme curve that this hummingbird gave up its ability to hover. What an incredible and diverse selection of bird beaks. Now the power is in your hands. You get to choose which of these birds will be the winner of the Battle of the Beaks. We've set up voting on our website, complete with photos of these fantastic bills. There is a link in our episode description, and it's also being shared widely on our Birds Canada social media. Share these episodes with your friends so that they can participate too. Voting is going to be open for around a month, so you've got some time to get lots of votes pulled in for your favorite bird. We will announce the winner in a future episode, so please be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out. Until next time, go look at some beaks. The Warblers is a podcast of Birds Canada. Our goal is to bring you the information you need to discover, enjoy, and protect birds. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, leave a review, and share this podcast with everyone you know. Birds Canada relies on the support of donors like you. Visit birdscanada.org/warblerspodcast to make a donation today. The Warblers is produced by Jody Allaire, Kate Dogleash, Chris Koo, and Andrea Gress, with music by Jose Mora and art by Alex Nickel. Until next time, keep birding.